The dining room of the Royal Hotel had high ceilings and tall insect-screened sash windows. The mechanical fans set in the roof stirred the warm, humid air sluggishly into a substitute for coolness, and Gareth Swales was a splendid host. His engaging charm was irresistible, and his choice of food and wine induced in Jake a sense of such well-being that they laughed together like old friends, and were delighted to find that they had mutual acquaintances, mostly barmen and brothel keepers in various parts of the world, and that they had parallel experience. Gareth had been doing business with a revolutionary leader in Venezuela, while Jake was helping build the railroad in that same country. Jake had been chief engineer on a Blake Line coaster on the China run when Gareth had been making contact with the Chinese communists on Yellow River. They'd been in France at the same time, and on that terrible day at Amiens, when the German machine guns had accelerated the Gareth Swales promotion from subaltern to major in the space of 6 hours, Jake had been 4 miles down the line, a sergeant driver in the Royal Tank Corps, seconded from the American Third Army. They discovered that they were almost of an age, neither of them yet 40, but that both of them had packed a world of experience and wandering into that short span. They recognised in each other that same restlessness that was always driving them on to new adventure, never staying long enough in one place or at one job to grow roots, unfettered by offspring or possessions, by spouse or responsibilities, taking up each new adventure eagerly and discarding it again without qualms or regrets, always moving onwards, never looking backwards. Understanding each other a little, they began to respect one another. Halfway through the meal, they were no longer scornful of each other's differences. Neither of them thought of the other as limey or yank any longer. But this didn't mean that Jake was about to accept any checks, or that Gareth had given up his plans to acquire the 5 armored cars. At last, Gareth swilled the last few drops around his brandy balloon and glanced at his pocket watch. 9 o'clock. Too early for bed? What should we do now? Jake suggested. There are 2 new girls down at Madame Cecile's. They came in on the mail boat. Gareth quickly turned the suggestion aside. Later, perhaps. Too soon after dinner. Gives me heartburn. You don't by any chance feel like a few hands at cards? There's usually a decent game down at the club. We can't go in there. We aren't members. I have reciprocity with my London club, old boy. Sign you in, what? They'd played for 1.5 hours. Jake was enjoying the game. He liked the style of the establishment, for he usually played in less salubrious surroundings. The back room behind the bar, an upturned fruit crate behind the main boiler in an engine room, or a scratch game in a dockside warehouse. This was a hushed room, with draped velvet curtains, expanses of dark wood panelling, dark-toned oil paintings and hunting trophies, shaggy-maned lions, buffalo with huge bossed horns, drooping mournfully, all of them staring down with glassy eyes from the walls. From the 3 billiard tables came the discreet click of the ivory balls, as 6 players in dress shirts and braces, black ties and black trousers, evening jackets discarded for the game, leaned across the heavy, green-topped tables to play their shots. There were 3 tables of contract bridge, from which came the murmur of bid and counter-bid in the cultivated tones of the British upper class, all the players in the dress that Jake thought of as penguin suits, black and white with black bows. Between the tables, the waiters moved on silent, bare feet, in ankle-length white robes and pillbox fez, like priests of some ancient religion, bearing trays of sparkling crystal glass. There was only 1 table of draw poker, a huge teak structure with brass ashtrays set into the woodwork, and niches and trays to hold the whiskey glasses and the coloured ivory chips. At the table sat 5 players, and only Jake was not in evening dress. The other 3 were the type of poker players that Jake would dearly love to have kept locked up for his exclusive pleasure. There was a minor British peer out in Africa to decimate the wildlife. He'd recently returned from the interior where a white hunter had stood respectfully at his elbow with a heavy caliber rifle, while the peer mowed down vast numbers of buffalo, lion, and rhinoceros. This gentleman had a nervous tic under his right eye, which jumped whenever he held three of a kind or better in his hand. Despite this affliction, a phenomenal run of good cards had allowed him to be the only winner, other than Jake, at the table. There was a coffee planter, with a deeply tanned and wrinkled face, who made an involuntary little hissing sound whenever he improvised on the draw or squeezed out a pleasing combination. On Jake's right hand was an elderly civil servant, with thinning hair and a fever yellow complexion, who broke out in a muck sweat whenever he judged himself on the point of winning a pot, an expectation which was seldom realized. In an hour's careful play, Jake had built up his winnings to a little over £100, and he felt very warm and contented down there where his dinner was digesting. The only element in his life that afforded him any disquiet was his new friend and sponsor. Gareth Swales sat at his ease, conversing with the peer as an equal, condescending graciously to the planter and commiserating with the civil servant on his run of luck. He had neither won nor lost any significant amount, yet he handled the cards with a dexterity that was impressive. In those long, tapering fingers, with the carefully manicured nails, the pasteboards rustled and rippled, blurred and snapped with a speed that defied the eye. Jake watched carefully, without appearing to do so, whenever the deal passed to Major Gareth Swales. There's no way that a dealer, even with the most magical touch, can stack a deck of cards without facing them during the shuffle. And Gareth never faced the deck as he manipulated it. His eyes never even dropped to the cards, but played lightly over the faces of the others as he chatted. Jake began to relax a little. The planter dealt him four to an open-ended flush, and he filled it with the six of hearts. The civil servant, who had an insatiable curiosity, called his raise to £20 and sighed and muttered mournfully as he paid the ivory chips into the pot, and Jake swept them away and stacked them neatly in front of him. "Let's have a new pack," smiled Gareth, lifting a finger for a servant, "and hope that it breaks your run of luck." Gareth offered the seal on the new pack for inspection, and then split it with his thumbnail and unwrapped the pristine cards with their bicycle wheel designs, fanned them, lifted the jokers, and began to shuffle, at the same time starting a very funny and obscene story about a bishop who entered the woman's restroom at Charing Cross Station in error. The joke took a minute or two in the telling, and in the roar of masculine laughter that followed, Gareth began to deal, skimming the cards across the green bays so that they piled up neatly before each player. Only Jake had noticed that during the bishop's harrowing experiences in the ladies' room, Gareth had blocked the cards between shuffles, and that each time as he lifted the two blocks, he'd rolled his wrists, so that for a fleeting instant they'd fanned slightly and faced. Guffawing loudly, the Baron gathered up his hand and looked at it. He choked in the middle of his next guffaw, and his eyelids started to jump and twitch, as though it were making love to his nose. From across the table came a loud hiss of indrawn breath, as the planter closed his cards quickly and covered them with both hands. At Jake's right hand, the civil servant's face shone like polished yellow ivory, and a little trickle of sweat broke from his thinning hairline, ran down his nose, and dripped unheeded onto the front of his dress shirt as he stared at his cards. Jake opened his own cards and glanced at the three queens it contained. He sighed and began his own story. "When I was first engineer on the old Harvest Maid, tied up in Kowloon, the skipper brought a fancy little dude on board and we all got into a game. The stakes kept jumping up and up, and just after midnight, the dude dealt one hell of a hand." Nobody appeared to be listening to Jake's story. They were all too absorbed with their own cards. "The skipper ended up with four kings. I got four jacks, and the ship's doctor pulled a mere four tens." Jake rearranged the queens in his hand and broke off his story while Gareth Swales fulfilled the civil servant's request for two cards. The dude himself took one card from the drawer, and the betting went mad. We were throwing everything we owned in the pot. Thanks, friend. I'll take two cards also. Gareth flicked two cards across the table, and Jake discarded from his hand before picking them up. As I was saying, we were almost stripping off under our pants to throw it all in the middle. I was in for a little over $1,000. Jake squeezed open the new cards. Could hardly suppress a grin. All the ladies were there. Four pretty little queens peered out at him. We signed IOUs, we pledged our wages, and the dude came right along on the ride, not pushing the betting, but staying right there. Gareth gave the Baron one card and drew one himself. They were listening now, eyes darting from Jake's lips to their own card. Well, when it came to the showdown, we were looking at each other across a pile of cash that came to the ceiling, and the dude hit us with a straight flush. I remember it so clearly in clubs, 3-8. Took the skipper and me 12 hours to recover from the shock, and we worked out the odds on that deal just happened naturally. It was something like 16,000,000 to 1. The odds were against the dude, and we went looking for him. Found him down at the old Peninsula Hotel, spending our hard-won gold. We were preparing for sea at the time. Our boilers were cold. We sat the dude on top of them and fired them. Had to tie him down, of course, and after a few hours, his knackers was roasting like chestnuts. By God, exclaimed the peer. How awful. Quite right, Jake agreed. Hell of a stink in my engine room. A heavy, charged silence settled over the table. All of them aware that something explosive was about to happen, that an accusation had been made, but both of them not certain what the accusation was and at whom it had been leveled. They held up their cards like protective shields, and their eyes darted suspiciously from face to face. The atmosphere was so tense that it pervaded the gracious room, and the players at the other tables paused and looked up. I think, Gareth Swales drawled, in crisp tones that carried to every corner of the listening room, that what Mr. Barton is trying to say is that somebody is cheating. That word, spoken in these surroundings, was so shocking, so charged with dire consequence, that strong men gasped and blanched. Cheating in the club, by God. Better a man be accused of adultery or ordinary murder. I must say that I have to agree with Mr. Barton. The icy blue eyes snapped with angry lights, and he turned deliberately to the bewildered member of the House of Lords beside him. I wonder if you'd be good enough, sir, to inform us as to the exact amount of our money that you have won. The voice cracked like a whiplash, and the peer stared at him with complete incomprehension for a moment, and then his face mottled purple and crimson, and he gobbled angrily. Sir, how dare you? Good God, sir! And he rose in his seat, breathless, choking with outrage. Have at him, cried Gareth, and overturned the heavy teak table with a single upward thrust of both hands. It crashed over, pinning the planter and the civil servant under it, and scattering ivory chips and playing cards in such profusion that nobody would ever know what cards Gareth Swales had dealt to himself in that last remarkable deal. Gareth leaned across the struggling mass of downed players and clipped the peer smartly under the left ear. Cheating, ha! Caught you cheating! The peer roared like a bull and swung a full-armed punch, under which Gareth ducked lightly, but which went on to catch the club secretary between the eyes as he hurried up to intervene. The room erupted into violence as the other members rushed in to assist the secretary. Jake tried to reach Gareth through the sudden seething storm of bodies. Not him, you! He shouted angrily, flexing his arms and knotting his fists. There were 40 members in the room. Only one person was not dressed in the uniform that showed that they belonged, Jake in his baggy moleskins, and the pack turned on him. Watch out behind you, old boy, Gareth warned Jake in a friendly fashion, as he reached out to take the lapels of Gareth's suit in his hands. Jake whirled to meet the rush of angry members, and the fists that were bunched for Major Swales thudded into the charging group. Two of them dropped, but the rest swarmed on. "Lay on," Gareth encouraged him merrily, "and damned be he who cries enough." Miraculously, he'd armed himself with a billet cue. By now, Jake was almost totally submerged under a heaving mound of black evening dress. There were three of them riding on his back, two hanging round his legs and one tucked under each of his arms.
"Not me, you fools, not me, him!"
He tried to point to Gareth, but both his arms were occupied.
"Quite right," Gareth agreed. "Dirty, cheating dog."
And he wielded the billiard cue with uncanny skill, holding it inverted and tapping the thick end smartly against the skulls of the well-dressed gentleman riding on Jake's back. They dropped away, and freed of their weight, Jake turned to Gareth once more.
"Listen," he bellowed,
advancing despite the bodies that clung onto his legs.
"Listen indeed,"
Gareth cocked his head, and the sound of a police whistle shrilled, and there were the glimpse of uniforms beyond the double doors.
"Peelers, by Jove," Gareth announced. "Perhaps we should move on. Follow me, old son."
With a few expert swings of the billiard cue, he knocked the glass from the window beside him and stepped lightly and unruffled into the darkened garden. Jake strode along the unlit footpath under the dark jacaranda trees. He followed the main road out towards his camp beside the stream. The outraged cries and the sound of police whistles had long since died away in the night behind. Jake's anger had also died away, and he chuckled once as he thought of the peer's purple face and his bulging, affronted eyes. Then, behind him, following along the dark street, he heard the rhythmic squeak of the springs of a rickshaw and the pad of bare feet. Even before he looked back, he knew who was following.
"Thought I'd lost you,"
Gareth Swells remarked lightly, his handsome, noble features lit by the glow of the cheroot between his teeth as he lolled against the cushions of the rickshaw.
"You took off like a long dog after a bitch. Fantastic turn of speed. I was very impressed."
Jake said nothing, but strode on towards his camp.
"You can't possibly be bound for bed."
The rickshaw kept stationed beside Jake. "The knight is still a pup, and who can say what beautiful thoughts and sterling deeds are still to be thought and performed?" Jake tried not to grin and kept going.
"Madame Cecile's?" Gareth wheedled.
"You really do want those cars, don't you?"
"I am hurt," announced Gareth, "that you should imply gross materialism to my friendly overtures."
"Who's paying?" demanded Jake.
"You are my guest."
"Well, I've drunk your beer, eaten your food. Why should I stop now?"
He stopped and walked to the rickshaw.
"Move over, then," he said.
The rickshaw driver wheeled in a tight turn and trotted back into the town, while Gareth pressed a cheroot between Jake's lips.
"What'd you deal yourself?" Jake asked, between puffs of the fragrant smoke. "Four aces? Straight flush?"
"I am appalled at the implied slur on my character, sir. I shall ignore the question."
They jogged a little further in silence until it was Gareth's turn to ask the next question.
"You didn't really roast that poor fellow's chestnuts, did you?"
"No,"
Jake admitted,
"but it made a better story."
They reached the door of Madame Cecile's, discreetly set back in a walled garden, with a lamp burning over the lintel. Gareth paused with his hand on the brass knocker.
"You know, damned if I don't owe you an apology. I misjudged you all along the line."
"It's been a lot of laughs."
"I think I'm going to have to be honest with you."
"I don't know if I can stand the shock."
They grinned at each other, and Gareth punched his shoulder lightly.
"Still my treat, what?"
Madame Cecile was so tall and thin and bosomless that she seemed in danger of snapping off like a brittle stick. She wore a severely cut dress of dark and indeterminate colour, which swept the ground and buttoned up under her chin and at the wrists. Her hair was drawn back tightly into a large bun at the back of her neck, and her expression was prim and disapproving. But it softened a little
when she led them in to the front room.
Major Swales, it is always a pleasure. Mr. Barton, we haven't seen you in a long while. I was afraid you'd left town.
Let us have a bottle of Charlie's Champers, my dear. Gareth handed his silk scarf to the maid. Have you run out of the Paul Roger 1923?
Indeed not, Major.
And we'd like to talk alone for a little while before meeting any of the young ladies. Is your private lounge vacant?
Gareth was settled comfortably in one of the big leather armchairs, with a glass of champagne in one hand and a cheroot in the other.
Il Duce is about to put himself into bat. God alone knows what he hopes to gain by it. From all accounts, it's the most desolate stretch of desert and mountain one could imagine. However, Mussolini wants it. Perhaps he has visions of empire and glory. The old Napoleonic itch, you know. How do you know about this?
Jake was sprawled on the buttoned couch across the room. He wasn't drinking the champagne. He didn't like the taste.
It's my business to know, old chap. I can smell out a Barney before the fellows themselves know that they're going to fight. This one is a racing certainty. Il Duce is going through all the classic stages of protestations of peaceful intentions combined with wholesale military preparations. The other big powers, France, our chaps, and yours, have given him the wink. Of course, they'll all squeal like blazes, make all sorts of protests at the League of Nations, but nobody is about to stop old Benito making a big grab for Ethiopia. Haile Selassie, the King of Kings, knows it. And so do all his princes, and rises, and chieftains, and merry men. And they're desperately trying to prepare some kind of defence.
That's where I come in, old boy.
Why must they buy from you?
At the prices you say they're offering.
Surely they could get this sort of stuff direct from the manufacturers.
Embargo, old chap. The League of Nations have slapped an arms embargo on the whole of Eritrea, Somaliland, and Ethiopia. No imports of war material into the area. It's intended to reduce tension. But, of course, it works out completely one-sided. Mussolini doesn't have to go shopping for his armaments. He has all the guns, aircraft, and armor that he needs, already landed at Eritrea, just ready to go. And the jolly old Ethiop has a few ancient rifles and a lot of those long two-handed swords. Should be a close match.
You aren't drinking your Charlie Champers.
I think I'll go get myself a Tusker.
Back in a minute.
Jake rose and moved to the door, and Gareth shook his head sadly.
You've got taste buds like a crocodile's back. Tusker, forsooth, when I'm offering you a vintage Charlie.
It was more for a chance to think out his position and plan his moves than desire for beer that made Jake seek the bar in the front room. He leaned against the counter in the crowded room, and his mind went swiftly over what Gareth Swales had told him. He tried to decide how much was fact and how much was fantasy, how the facts affected him, and where, if there were any, the profits to himself might lie. He'd almost decided not to involve himself in the deal. There were too many thorns along the path, and to go ahead with his original intentions, selling the engines as cane-crushing units, when he was made the victim of one of those coincidences which were too neat not to be one of the sardonic jokes of fate. Beside him at the bar were two young men in the sober dress of clerks or accountants. Each of them had a girl tucked under his arm, and they fondled them absent-mindedly as they talked in loud, assertive voices. Jake had been too busy making his decision to follow this conversation until a name caught his attention.
By the way, did you hear that Anglo Sugar has gone bang?
Yeah, I don't believe it.
It's true. Heard it from the master of the court himself. They say they've gone bust for 500,000.
Good God.
That's the third big company this month.
Hard times we live in. This'll bring down a lot of little men with it.
Jake agreed silently. He poured the beer into his glass, tossed a coin on the counter, and headed back for the private lounge. They were hard times indeed, Jake thought. This was the second time in as many months that he'd been caught up in them. The freighter on which he'd arrived in Dar es Salaam as chief engineer had been seized by the sheriff of the court as surety in a bankruptcy action. The owners had gone bust in London, and the ship had been unable to pay off. Jake had walked down the gangplank with all his worldly possessions in the kit bag over his shoulder, abandoning his claim to almost 6 months' back wages, together with all his savings in the bankrupt company's pension fund. He'd just started to shape up with the cane crusher contract, and once again the tidal waves of depression sweeping across the world had swamped him. They were all going bang, the big ones and the small. And Jake Barton now found himself the owner of 5 armored cars, for which there remained but a single buyer in the market. Gareth was standing by the window, looking down to the harbour, where the lights of the anchored ships flickered across the dark waters. He turned to face Jake, and went on as though there'd been no break in the conversation. "While we're still being disgustingly honest with each other, let me estimate that the Ethiopians would pay as much as £1,000 each for those vehicles. Of course, they'd have to be spruced up, coat of paint, machine gun in the turret." "I'm still listening." Jake sank back on the couch. "I still have the buyer lined up, and the vicar's machine guns, without which the cars have no value. You have the vehicles themselves and the technical know-how to get them working." Jake was seeing a different man in Gareth Swales now. The lazy, drawling voice and foppish manner were gone. He spoke crisply, and once again there was the piratical blue sparkle in his eyes. "I've never worked with a partner before. I always knew that I could do it better on my own. But I've had a chance to get a good look at you. This could be the first time. What do you think?"
"If you cross me, Gareth, I will truly roast your chestnuts for you."
Gareth threw back his head and laughed delightedly.
"I believe you really would, Jake."
He crossed the room and offered his hand. "Equal partners, you put in the cars, I'll throw in my pile of goodies. Everything down the middle?" he asked, and Jake took the hand.
"Right down the middle," he agreed.
"Well, that's enough business for tonight. Let's meet the ladies."